Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Peach State Pandemonium. Today is July 17, 2014. This is Michael Norris. And as always, I am joined by my three musketeer partners, Jerry Oates, Bobby Simmons, and Jay West. How are you guys doing this evening?
Doing good, sir.
I'm glad to be here.
Me too, and I'm glad Jerry Oates is here. I got a question for him.
Shoot.
Explain to me what the employee of the quarter of the month is, man. I'm proud. I mean, I want to know about this.
I was shocked.
You was. You should have heard me.
I got a nice certificate, got a gift certificate, had to make a speech, was on TV.
Wow.
And listen, fellas, this happened last week, and all I've read about in the paper this week is Tybee Island. wanting a nude beach down there. I figured that was the employee of the quarters idea. And then now we got a casino boat stuck on a sand barge or something.
Well, what happened? That casino boat passed by the nude beach and he run us on the rock. No, that new beach.
I figured that's
happened.
Why they gave Jerry.
I didn't figure. Yeah, they said the mayor went crazy when that came up.
that was Jerry's bribe. They made him employee of the quarter if he wouldn't vote for the new beach.
Well, I volunteered to patrol that section. So.
Well, I'm proud of you, son. That's good.
Yes, sir.
You never got no employee of the quarter in the wrestling business, did you?
I never got an employee of the night, much less a quarter.
And you didn't have to worry about being on the booker's good side in order to get this, did you?
That is correct. You are correct. that was nice honor, you know.
Did you wear your Oates Brothers T-shirt?
No, I wore the McGuire one.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if you wore that while you were on TV.
Yeah.
being a little more legit in the questions here, how long have you worked there, Jerry?
Almost 5 years.
All right.
Yeah, and I love it. It's a good bunch of people, good guys I work with, and I'm blessed to be able to do it. I really am.
Well,
it sounds like a great spot to be working.
Do what, Jay?
Sounds like a great spot down there, you know, to be in, location wise and everything, to have a job. That sounds great.
And, you know, I look forward to going to work every day. It's something different all the time, you know. It's just, it's nice.
It's not everybody gets up and heads to the beach to go to work, so that can't be a bad deal.
It's really not, Bob.
I'm telling you, it's not. I head to a stinking office building every day, so I know it's got to be good.
Leaving out, guys, is the fact that they gave him that job because he was hanging around there bothering the swimmers anyway. So they figured if he's going to be there, they might as well hire him and give him something to do.
Exactly.
Down there selling autographed pictures. And they thought, wait a minute.
I have a lot of people stop me to say that. When I'm on the beach, a lot of people stop me and say, do they actually pay you to do this? I said, no, really, too. I have to pay them to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm blessed. Man. I really am.
Before we get into anything, I'm going to let Jay read our commercial for us, or do our commercial for us, and then I've got a couple of little things to discuss before we get into our program for tonight. So I'm going to turn it over to Jay to make GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com a little money here.
Okay, thank you very much. Tonight's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/GWHradio. Okay, hopefully that, is that take one? Do we get to do that again? No.
No, I think we're blessed to have a voice like that on this show.
No kidding. I still want to know
before we get going, I don't know if y'all know Ralph Reed. Lost his wife, Mr. Ward's daughter.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was going to talk about was Francis, just losing Francis Freed this week.
Yeah.
I was going to let you and Bobby, because I figured you guys knew her better than, certainly better than me, and probably better than Jay. You were around her more.
I will have to defer to Jerry. I met her in passing, but was not around her much at all.
No, she didn't participate much in, you know, our business, like Rose did, of course. She went in, she was complaining about shortness of breath Friday. And they took her in and they did a triple bypass on her. She had three arteries that were like 95% blocked. And her heart just couldn't, she didn't make it. Her heart was too weak, they said. So, that, you know, she just didn't make it.
Well, certainly our condolences go out to the family.
Yep, for sure. I mean, I've known her. They called her Frankie.
Yep.
I knew her from the time I was seven, eight, 9 years old.
Yeah, it was in reading the obituary, her and Ralph were married 57 years.
Right.
Wow.
And I trust me, fellas, I know exactly how he feels. But me and Debbie had been married almost 27, but,
right.
Man, poor Ralph's going to be lost.
Yep.
Keep good thoughts going as well.
Really just bad shape. And, you know, it was unexpected, you know.
Yep.
You know, totally unexpected. And I found out about it sometime late Saturday morning. Ted told me, of course, Ted was married to Frankie's daughter, which was Mr. Ward's granddaughter, and Ted's daughter called him Saturday morning and told him that her grandmother had died. And that's how I found out Saturday morning. So it was totally a shock.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jay.
I was just going to mention, on a similar note, quoting from the Wrestling Observer newsletter about longevity here and passing away, Audrey Russell, who was the wife of longtime wrestling announcer Lance Russell, she passed away on June 28th on the date of their 67th wedding anniversary.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, man.
So that's just, it's no one lives forever, but they certainly had a lot of years together, and our thoughts go out to Mr. Russell also.
Yeah, that's a long time together.
You're not kidding.
That it is. I was going to wait. What was, other than being Red's son-in-law, what was Ralph's connection to the business? I'm assuming he did work for the promotion there.
He did. Ralph was responsible for getting a lot of TV equipment there, better TV equipment that they used for the TV. They had their own equipment they used, and of course it was live TV. And he did a lot of the booking, and then when him and Leon, the other brother-in-law, or son-in-law, right. Of Mr. Ward, they take turns doing the booking and. They put in a lot of hours, I know that. They had quite a few towns, you know, Macon, Columbus, and Auburn, and then they ran spot shows, America's different shows, and they worked hard, they did, and then when it wound up, I don't know, Bobby may know more about this, I don't know how, but it wound up with really Ralph and Holy running the thing there at the end.
Yeah, that was...
But you was gone then, Bobby, wasn't you?
Yeah, I left right as all that went down, and I was there about 2 days. Ralph was Ole's ace in the hole to carry that end of the promotion, I mean, to carry that southern end. I mean, he got to him, and Ralph convinced Mr. Ward, because Mr. Ward was up in years.
Yep.
But Ralph was very smart when it came to TV production and that sort of stuff. Not only did he get better equipment in there, they wound up with their own production truck. I mean, they could take that truck. They used to come to Atlanta. We used to do a show on Tuesdays at the old sports arena. We would, when I first went to work over there in 74, every Tuesday afternoon about 1 o'clock, we did a TV taping. And
I remember that.
Yeah, that was the tape that they were sending that tape to Albany. They were sending it to Savannah. Might even been sending it to Augusta. I don't remember, but they were making a totally separate show besides
right.
from the Atlanta tape
right.
To send to the other stations around, so that they weren't seeing the same thing.
As a matter of fact, I think they may have even been doing different tracks for those different cities, audio
yes,
tracks.
Yes, they were, because they brought Jim Carlisle would come up and he would be at one desk.
Right.
And they used Freddie Miller at another desk, and they had a third guy. I don't even remember who it was, but they had three desks going.
Right.
But yeah, that was all Ralph's truck. Ralph was the TV guy behind that.
I know during the heyday, the Saturday afternoon show in Columbus, but did they do a show in Macon, TV show?
Yeah, we used to. Used to tape it on Thursdays. The announcer
down there. But hard show to do or what, Bob?
Oh, geez, that guy down there. He was some kind of local celebrity, and he was a goof, and his catchphrase was people.
People
I ain't really
people.
Figured out what that meant, but hello, people, and that was the way, you know. But that was his deal, and he was over in Macon. But yeah, that was we dressed in the tape. I guess it was tape or. Storage room or something. They had a bathroom with a sink. There was no shower. And then and when you left there on Thursday, when I first started doing it, you either had to go to Athens or Savannah.
No. Savannah was on Tuesday.
Well, they changed it to Thursday because we used to go from that Macon TV to Savannah. After they bumped it off Tuesday, they moved it to Thursday in that big building, trying to make it draw better.
Well, we discussed that. Nobody can make that thing draw. So.
they couldn't have drew there if we'd have wrestled naked.
Remember when we used to go to the boarding house there and eat after
yes.
the matches?
Yes, sir. That was the best part about going.
I know we used to go to either. I know at one time we went to either Athens or to Albany from there.
Yeah, well, they moved to Albany to Tuesday.
What year did they do that, Bobby? I must have been gone.
Must have been 75. You were in Kansas City.
Yeah, I wasn't here.
You and Ted were in Kansas City because you went to Macon, or because I knew it used to kill you to have to go to Albany. You'd go right by that Macon exit, knew you had another 100 miles to go. And them guys wasn't going to leave home for another hour, and it was going to beat you home by 2 hours. But, yeah, that was... Yeah, we used to, you know, and that TV that Macon was like any other TV. It never started on time. It never finished on time. And when you got through, don't even think about eating nothing if you was going to Savannah. Because the interstate ran about 50 miles south of that or east of that TV station, and then you had two-lane road for 100 miles.
That's a long stretch.
And every policeman in every town knew we was coming, and they'd sit there and wait on us.
And they weren't looking for autographs, were they?
No, they weren't. The only other, they were, at the bottom of that little page they had. But I'll tell you another trip that used to just be a killer. And, of course, Jerry Lemon in Columbus, now I'm sure he made this trip, but he would have made it from Columbus. A real heartbreaker would be booked in Statesboro on a Friday night when Atlanta was running.
No, I made that one a minion night.
Oh, geez, you had to get in your car in Atlanta about 3:30 and drive to Statesboro, and you knew when you got there. Even and they drew, you know, Mr. Newman promoted that, and he drew some pretty good little houses, but the building was so small, you knew you was going to make the guarantee, and that's it. And most of the guys had to make TV the next morning, even though they had that trip. It was a killer.
Then you had to face Saturday. Saturday wasn't no joke around here, man.
No, sir.
There was no joke. Of course, we didn't wrestle on Sundays, which the crash a little bit. And they started running Marietta on Sundays.
Right.
Did that on Sunday night. They ran Savannah for. Was you here when they was running Savannah on Sunday afternoons?
No.
Delta Airlines. It cost you $75 back then to fly round trip from Atlanta to Savannah, and we only made $65. That was the guarantee. So I went $10 in the hole, but I would fly down there rather than drive that 8 hours in the car on Sunday. And one Sunday I was sitting on a plane, and Barnett got on the plane, and he looked at me and he said, "What are you doing?" And I told him, I said, "Jim, I said, we work 6 days a week." And I said, I can't be in a car 8 hours on Sunday for, you know. I said, I got to have some time with my family. And I said, this makes this a 6 hour day rather than a 10 or 12 hour day. And he started paying everybody's trans. Everybody started flying in, and the office paid for it. But that didn't last long.
And this has nothing to do with the wrestling business, but if you're a fan of music, especially blues music, we lost a great this morning, Johnny Winter. He was on tour. He was on tour in Switzerland. They found him dead in his hotel room in Zurich this morning. He was 70 years old.
Well, once again, long career. If you got to go, that's the way to do it.
Yep. In fact, he's touring with his brother Edgar. It was the first time they've toured together, as far as I know, since the 70s. Of course, most people know Edgar because he had the big hit Frankenstein back in the 70s. Johnny never had a hit, but he was well known.
Right, and they had that long flowing blonde hair, albinos.
Albinos, yep.
Very
unusual. Nobody's ever been in the wrestling business other than Tim Woods. It was an albino, and Tim wasn't real.
I don't know. Leon Baxter was pretty white.
You talking about Tarzan Baxter? He wore
that
white outfit.
Yeah, I never saw him with a tan either.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe on one arm from his arm hanging out the car window of a squad car while he was pulling radar.
I thought maybe that's what Adrian Street was covering up, you know, with the makeup he wore.
Jeez.
The Winter Brothers were. I never got into Johnny or Edgar's music that much. He was more progressive as far as. You know, prog rock, stuff like that, but I love Johnny Winters. He couldn't sing worth a lick, but he could play the guitar. Oh, in fact, the very first 8-track, I'm dating myself now, the very first 8-track tape I ever bought was Johnny Winter Live. Started out with Good Morning, Little Schoolgirl, and ended with Johnny Be Good.
Well, see, you still got memories there. Do you still have that 8-track?
No, but if I'm able to rescue it and get it clean, I've got the CD of that album.
Okay.
I remember my grandmother telling me about 8-tracks.
Yeah. Bobby still remember when the first stereo Bobby had in his car was one of those Fisher-Price turntables that you could play. You could ride in the car and play. Speaking of getting old, so somebody's birthday is today, and I'm going to get him on the line with us so we can embarrass him. So hang on just a minute. Happy birthday, Bo James.
Well, thank you very much.
What are you trying to pass off like you're 40, but I don't think you can get as ugly as you are in just 40 years.
Well, I guess I'm officially middle-aged and crazy now.
Well, the crazy part you've had covered for a while.
Yeah, I've had that since I was a teenager.
Well, how'd your birthday bash show go the other night?
Well, that wasn't my show. A friend of mine ran that, and as we left with the rain yesterday, he was standing on the street corner crying. So.
Oh, geez.
Did he have a boxer selling his T-shirt for a dollar or something?
No. He had a price for a ring and a crew, and, you know, he thought hanging 50 flyers in a town of 60-some thousand people was going to draw a house. Plus, running against a free movie in the park and Kingsport Idol 2 blocks over from where we were at. You can't run against festivals.
Mm-mm-mm. But he was a promoter.
Yeah, he was a promoter. He promoted
promoter.
Three events. He promoted three events this week, and between the three, I think he drew about 65 people.
Whoa. Jeez.
So, everybody thinks it's easy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I got another question. I mean, you know, in a town, you know, I've spent a total of 3 days there in my life. But, you know, Wednesdays, major cities, you could run on Wednesdays. But I was smart enough even way back when to know you couldn't go into a town of 60,000 I consider to be a small town. You can't go in there and run against church on Wednesday night.
No.
It's tough.
I mean, even our metro's a little over 200,000. Kingsport, John City, and Bristol all three together. But you can't, when they've had this festival for 35 years, it's citywide and goes week long. And now it's actually even grown outside the city because the event we did Saturday night at the fairgrounds was part of the festival that drew 5,000 people. You know, and I tried, when he called me to do this, I tried to tell him, you don't want to do it, you know. And then I tried for the last 2 weeks. I kept asking him, you know, do you want me to help you? Nope, got it covered. I know what I'm doing. So,
famous last words.
Yeah. Yeah. As he was handing out the money last night, you know, you could see the tears starting to roll.
Oh, gee.
So, he's a good guy, but. You know, not everybody's made for promoting business or the wrestling business.
Well, it's good to know the guys got their payoff, and, you know, that leaves them with a decent feeling about the guy. He didn't take off and leave them in the lurch.
No, he delivered on everything he promised. You know, I'm just glad I didn't have to go home and face his wife with him.
Cool.
What's going on that you need somebody to haul a ring for you?
Oh, that's the deal in Knoxville. They're trying to find a ring truck. Mine stays on a bus.
Somewhere on that bus is a nipple.
Yep, somewhere on that bus is a nipple. If it ain't fell out.
Oh. So they're trying to find a ring, or they got a ring, or are they just looking for a ring
they
truck?
Got a ring,
or
they just trying to, they got a ring, they're just trying to find somebody to pull it 10 miles.
Tell them to call Mac McMurray. He's got experience doing that.
Yeah, I never thought of that. So Mac will be there at 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I say you get him involved, he'll break his neck to get it done. But I got news for you. If it involves toting that ring up them steps, listen, I went to their TV taping when I was up there a few weeks ago. They run it in a ballroom in the Civic Center, Knoxville Civic Center. The only way to get the ring in is to tote it up 2 or 3 flights of steps.
Three.
Every piece. And I was watching them boys in there unloading it, and I thought, not me.
It makes my back hurt just hearing.
Listen, the worst place we had in Georgia, bar none, was a place in Gainesville, Georgia, called the Gym of 36. And the reason it was called that is because to get in the place, you had to go up 36 steps. And it set up off the ground. I mean, there was no other way into the building. And, buddy, you didn't have to put that ring in there but one time, and you'd lay that, you'd pray at night. You'd go, Lord, please don't let them run this ever again.
Years ago there, when Fuller did TV up there, I helped put the ring up when I was a kid. But we had one that broke down 8-foot sections. So we'd take the poles and the side pieces in and put them on the elevator and go up, and then come back and get the cross rails, take them back up. It took about 4 trips, but it was all on the elevator.
Yeah, we had 2 rings here in Georgia that were 8-foot pieces that we kept, and they were designed. The whole ring would lay on the bed of a pickup truck.
Yeah, that's the way this ring was.
And then we had 16-foot with the, you know, like you've got with the cross beam bars and the whole bit, and then we had 18, and then Mr. Newman, or I guess it was Mr. Newman's son Ron, built one, I think it was like 20 or 22 feet. That was like wrestling in somebody's living room.
I've never understood them big, anything over 18 feet is just too big.
Well, Jerry Oates can tell you that ring they had at the auditorium in Atlanta for 100 years, that thing was 24 by 24. You remember that old ring, Jerry? You had to run for a week.
One of the worst rings in the whole state. It was the worst ring. St. Louis had a 24-foot ring.
When we took that ring out the auditorium, Jerry, you know what we put in there?
What?
One of them wood rings that Dick built.
Those wooden rings, I didn't like them.
You didn't like Dick's rings? The only thing I didn't like about them, the ropes were too short.
I didn't like them. I like a 16-foot ring.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever seen any video of wrestling in Toronto?
Not that
I've seen video. You talking about where they got that ramp? It's the same level as the ring they walk out.
Yeah,
to.
But
the poles are inside the ring on that one. It had an apron probably 8 feet at times.
I was going to say the apron on it was a good 4 feet wide. You could work out there all day and never even have to get in the ring.
Yeah, Pittsburgh and Cleveland was that way too, and Buffalo. So at one time they were all one territory. So I guess they had the same guy build all the rings there.
Hmm.
Well, hang in here with us, Bo, because you can weigh in on some of this. Our little subject tonight is we're going to talk about wrestling strong men, not only ones who did the strong man type gimmick, but ones who were legitimately strong, and then guys who you could look at, never in the world think that they were all that strong, but they were. I guess, and Jerry, you probably remember this guy, probably the first that ever came out of being a strong man and kind of the wrestling business was George Hackenschmidt. Did you ever work with him?
Yeah, he was still on the board.
That's because he'd been dead for about 40 years.
I should have posed that question to Charlie. He was probably around back then.
Yeah, Hackenschmidt was something else, man. He was, all the pictures I've seen of him, he was legit. He was legit.
And then I guess coming along a couple decades after him was Dickie's dad, Milo. Wasn't he a strong man first, Jerry?
Yeah. He of course, Hackenschmidt was like 20 years older than Milo. And when Milo, he got to this country, he went to a lifting meet, I think in Philadelphia. You know, he was speaking his English or anything. He was lifting some lifts, and so he he didn't know any technique. Like, I mean, those belly, I don't know, he was like a bodybuilder. Yeah, like a long story short, he set 3 world records that day. And he finally told him to put 500 pounds on the bar. I mean, this is, I'm talking about probably in the late 20s. I may be off a few years, but it was early. And they told him, well, what are you going to do with it? This story he told me. He told him he was going to squat with him. They didn't have no squat rack, none of that stuff. So they told him to put 500 pounds on the bar. And they asked him, I guess he had an interpreter, how are you going to get that on your shoulders? He's trying to get it up there. They got 500 pounds on the bar, and he goes to one end of this bar and stands it up and lays it across his back and squats with it.
Who is this?
He's the first man in the world. First man in the world to squat with 500 pounds.
Jeez.
He made a lot of money wrestling. I don't know who got him in the business, but he got in the business, and I mean, he went all over. And he told me, I was in awe of him. A guy come over here, and all he had was this unbelievable body from back then. And, a lot of the guys, they weighed like 165, 175, 180 pounds, the wrestlers. He weighed like 215. And Charlie Harbin told me the first time he ever saw him in the line, he said it was absolutely unbelievable. He said nobody had ever seen anybody look like him. And he said he walked off that stage in Atlanta, and only Charlie Harvey could tell it. He said those broads went crazy when he come off the stage. He was said his vascular had veins all over and muscles, and he was handsome. And he was ahead of his time. If he lived in today's world, he still don't know what he looked like. Yeah, he was legit. He was legit. He was a legit strong man. And who followed him in our business, I don't know. I don't know. Of course, Kim Patero,
Well, probably in the 50s. And Jay, I know you probably, Doug, I said in the 50s is the first time that I remember, and of course I don't remember because I wasn't alive then, but going back and doing research, the ones that really, the one that got the biggest push as far as being a strong man was the Mighty Atlas. Which, he was about Don Serrano size, but he did the strongman gimmick. Supposedly you couldn't keep him in a full Nelson or a bear hug or anything like that.
I remember seeing him on TV as a kid.
Yeah. And then in the late 50s was probably Sailor R. Thomas. He did all the strongman type things. You couldn't knock him off his feet, and if you ran into him, you fell down, and, he'd do a,
What he did for a living? You know what he did for a living?
No. I mean, I know he was a merchant seaman at one time, how he got his gimmick, but he did something outside of the ring. I know there in...
he worked on Greyhound buses. He was a mechanic.
That's right. He worked for Greyhound. He was Madison, Wisconsin. Isn't that where he was from?
I think you're right. And I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of meeting him. I doubt it. I mean, he was...
No.
Way ahead of your time. But he was one of the nicest guys. He was a super nice guy, unbelievable body, just as nice a man as you ever want to meet.
He's the only guy I ever heard of lost an eye working out.
Wow.
He had a spring break pulling the old spring, and it broke and went into his eye.
Well, the legitimate strongman with the credentials of the 50s, who did work a little bit in the 60s, even though you don't see a lot of information even when you look on Wikipedia, is Paul Anderson from Georgia.
I remember him more from wasn't he more in the 60s?
His gold medal, all of that as an amateur was in the 50s. And in the Melbourne Olympics, super heavyweight division, he won the gold medal. And he was considered a professional by 1960 and billed himself as the world's strongest man, which I would imagine there was no disputing that. 5'9", 360 pounds. And I've seen there's not a lot of footage on him because in the 50s during that time, you know, you didn't have that much. You had photographs, but you didn't have even a lot of film. But the guy was unbelievable. But I remember seeing him occasionally on Live Atlanta Wrestling, you know, because he lived in Toccoa. And he wouldn't work on TV. He was a big attraction, and he didn't do it for a very long period of time. But he was a phenomenal-looking guy, and he took all, as I understand it, he took all the money that he made from professional wrestling that he made and put it into his youth home. He was a very devout Christian, and that's pretty much he made his living in his later life as a speaker. That's where his money went. But he was a phenomenal looking guy and is legit a strong man as you would ever find.
Charlie Smith told me that he used to ride a bicycle.
Yes.
And Charlie said he got a ticket in Pittsburgh, Tennessee. He got a speeding ticket on his bicycle. Now, I got the story right now, but that's something Charlie told me. He said. I believe it was Pittsburgh, Tennessee, but he said, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that story for years, where he was coming off Mont Eagle Mountain, going to Chattanooga.
But he was one of those attractions, you know, that they would bring in, and it would bring folks in to see him. But he wouldn't stick around long because that, you know, professional wrestling was really not his forte, and it's not something that he wanted to spend a lot of time with, but he used it to his advantage both for himself and for the promoter when the time was right.
I wonder how he was to work with.
Well, I don't think he was one of those guys that was, you weren't going to give him too many punches and he was going to, you know, roll with it.
Well, I would imagine not.
That's about as stiff a guy you're going to find, you know, like hitting a rock.
And, he worked Kingsport in the 50s, late 50s. He was always in handicap matches, usually just 2 weeks and done.
Yeah, and I would imagine it was a lot different than going against the McGuire twins.
It was nothing like that. Even teaming with them. I still have nightmares about that.
Around about the same time Bruno Sammartino came along, and that was at the beginning of his career. He was nearly 300 pounds, power lifter. And there again, you know, he was all hyped because of his strength and everything. And, of course, by the time he finished his career, he was down to about 240 pounds or so, real slim, but you know, much slimmer than he was at the beginning of his career. And was no longer considered a power athlete that he was at the beginning of his career.
Yeah, if you look at pictures of him early in his career, you know, the photos they would take with the really, I mean, big guy with a hairy chest and the slick back hair. And, I mean, he was quite heavy, and that gave him the big weightlifter look. But later on, he slimmed down quite a bit, went through that period where he wore that rug on his head. But he used the bear hug as a finish. And what I've read about him said he was it was kind of a storybook thing. He was a sickly type child in Italy. And when he came over here, he started doing weight training. He set a bench press record of 565 pounds in 1959, according to my research, and was the only guy, and I don't know if it was, just something for the show or whatnot, but whether it was legit or not, but he was the only guy listed to pick up Haystacks Calhoun, who was listed as 640 pounds, which I'm sure was a TV deal, but it was something that they promoted. But I only saw Bruno a couple of times, and that was late in his career when he worked here. But, you know, I think everybody that had the chance to say they actually saw this guy because he sold out so many shows in New York, and when he went away, odds fell, and they had to bring him back. But definitely the living legend, which is what he's been called. I think he certainly deserved that title.
And everybody, I mean, he wasn't the greatest worker in the world. He got by on his charisma. I mean, there's no doubt that he drew unbelievable crowds, you know, in the Northeast. But everybody that I know that's ever worked with him or been around him, and he said he's the nicest guy in the world. You know, just cares the way he cares himself and everything. He's just the epitome of what a professional is supposed to be. And then we got into the childlike Polish strongman, Mighty Igor. Of course, Dick Garza was a former bodybuilder, Mr. Michigan, weightlifter. But he was so successful with that gimmick that it was still being ripped off 15 years later. And it started with Ivan Putski.
I met Garza. He was wrestling here in Georgia as Johnny Bruce.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I was either 16 or 17 years old, and I went down to the arena. And Mr. Ward told me that he was upstairs working out. They had a gym upstairs in the arena, and I went up there. I was talking to him, and he's a nice guy. I mean, he was really built then. I mean, he had a little bitty waist. I mean, he was huge. I mean, big shoulders, big chest, great legs. He told me he used to climb up a telephone pole with a horse strapped around him. Well, he's a legit strong guy, too. And he was Mr. Michigan and all that stuff. And we got to talk about working out. And I told him my back bothered me a lot, like doing sit-ups. And he showed me something to do for my abs. I still do them to this day. Yeah,
wow.
It don't hurt your back at all. Yeah, he was very knowledgeable. Then later on, when he was, you know, changed and became a Mighty Igor, I couldn't believe it. He didn't make a nickel as Johnny Bruce. But
I wonder how he felt about Putski after Putski started.
I'm sure he didn't like it. I mean, the first time I met Putski, he was Joe Bonarski.
Right,
in Florida. He wrestled as, this was so funny. This was my first start. He would just come, I think he was a school teacher, and he would just come to Florida, you know, in the summer for like a vacation, you know. He wrestled down there. I mean, what a body he had then. And he wrestled as Hercules Bonarski. Well, the veteran room, yeah, where we were, and they locked the door. He's beating on the door. I said, who is it? He said, Hercules. Whoever it was, Hercules, come on in. But he did. Yeah, he was, you know, ribbing him. Yeah, he made a lot of money with that, though. He made a lot of money in Texas, I know that.
Yeah.
Well, Igor, you know, he was one of those guys that they would send a tape, I'm sure Bobby's familiar with this, they'd send a tape ahead of time showing his feats of strength. And when he would come in, he would usually work with the announcer, and he would do something where he would bend iron bars or some block would be put on his head, and somebody crack it with a hammer, and he'd do the bear hug or something of that nature just as a setup. And then many times the heel would come out and challenge him. But that's the way he would come into the territory. But, you know, in my opinion, I don't think his gimmick could work today, even with all the outlandish things you see on WWE, because it just wouldn't be politically correct. He's the kind of childlike, slow guy playing with toys in the middle of the ring. I'm sure someone with some organization would find some problem with it, and he would be banned. But, you know, a lot of kids loved him. And they'd come to the arena to see the Mighty Igor.
The toys wasn't that big a deal, but when he'd throw that sausage in your face, and he'd been in his suitcase for about 6 weeks, son, it was awful.
And we are talking about Polish sausage, correct?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, we are. He came in here. He had Ivan Kamelkov as his manager, and. they rode with me on the loop on a Saturday. And I can remember they wanted to stop. They would pass the side of the road, there'd be a garbage pile or something. They'd want to stop. One of them, I forget which one of them collected beer cans. And they were looking for, you know, unique beer cans or something. And they were upset because they couldn't find any Billy Beer. That was about the time Billy Beer was out. And it was just, you know, they weren't here very long. You remember, Jay, were you still there when they did the deal on TV where he put the two chains around his arm and then you had three or four guys on either side and tried to separate his arms? They did that on TV.
You know, I can remember seeing him doing that.
They did that on Atlanta TV.
That's something that he did a lot of places. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure I was. But, yes, that was one of his routines.
When you Putski. It was bad enough with him doing it, and then McGurk and Rick Ferrer called him Igor Putski, and they had the Putski cousins. And Rick Ferrer did it even later on. He was Depot Bonet. And even the original Steve Lawler, Steve Kyle, the last time I saw him, he was doing that gimmick. He was just Steve Kyle, but he was, you know, had to cut off shorts and the Eagle type outfit and would bring toys to the ring and stuff like that. But it got over enough where the promoters wanted to. And then you're talking about strongman feats. I guess it was Pepper Gomez who was famous for having somebody climb a ladder and jump off on his stomach. And, of course, he always fell to lift fell for it and let Ray Stevens jump off on his throat from the ladder.
They did that in Atlanta with Dick the Bruiser.
Really?
I don't know. I was when it was live Atlanta wrestling. I remember that. I was a kid. And they did that back when you could show blood on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Did the old condom in the mouth deal. And, yeah, it was that was pretty intense as a kid seeing that.
And then Reggie Parks did something similar. He would let people drive a car over him for his cast iron stomach. And I'm sure that was gimmick somehow, but I don't know how. But
I've been run over a lot of times. I didn't know you could get paid for it.
Usually they would do that with some type of cutout underneath the ground where they would replace the concrete with some type of sand substance or something like that, and then when it would run over, you just kind of sink into the sand. But you had to be real careful when you were doing that stuff. That's real carny stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, Mike, but but you know, they had to be careful how they would do that, because if you messed with the thing and you blew the gimmick, then it was out the window.
Very true. You guys, what Bobby was talking about with the chains, I actually participated in something like that, except we used leather straps with Joe LaDuke. We did it on Dothan TV one Saturday. There were four or five of us on either arm of him. He'd lock his hands together, and we'd be pulling on that leather strap trying to pull his hands apart. Joe, I think, would fall into one of those deceptively strong, because you'd look at him and, you know, he was always heavy and he wasn't real muscular and cut like a bodybuilder, but that is, I guarantee you, that's the strongest person I've ever been in a ring with.
Yeah, he was an animal.
Yeah.
Didn't he pull buses or something, Bobby, in Atlanta?
Yeah, he pulled buses.
Bus, yep.
Yeah.
He got hurt doing that because they did it in Vern's territory, and he pulled the first time, and if you see it, he kind of slips. At the film that they show, he slips. That was the second time he pulled it. The first time he pulled it, the guy didn't even turn the camera on. He thought it was a rib. He said, there's no way he'll do it. So they're out there in the freezing cold. He pulls the bus. They said, did you get it? I didn't even turn the camera on.
Oh,
I was watching him. So they had to do it a second time, and the second time they did it, when they got to the end, Joe slipped on the ice and he threw his back out.
Joe also did something that I've seen film of. I didn't see him do it live, but he would stand with his back up against a brick wall have somebody pull a car up close to him. He'd put his feet on both his feet on the front bumper and have him, you know, step on the gas and pull the drive forward. And he'd push it back with his feet, and the wheels would be spinning.
Yeah, several guys used to do that. I think Patera did that too.
Did he? And there's another one, you know, weightlifter Jim Patera, who probably out of all the weightlifter types that got into the business, probably was the best adapting to the wrestling business. He made he was a good worker after a while.
He really was.
And, especially after he slimmed down and got to where he was more of a bodybuilder type than a powerlifter type.
Well, he another thing in his favor was he, you know, I guess because of all the press coverage and everything, and he was very photogenic, but he could do a pretty good interview. And so I think that went a long way with helping his career. Plus, he had the look, and as you said, he could work. He had the credentials, and he finished third in the ABC World Strongest Man contest in 1977, which was good for him. He worked in you know, a lot of the major areas, the AWA, of course, and then Mid-Atlantic and WWF and here, of course, I remember him quite well. And, you know, he was, I think with his credentials, he was probably the total package when you look at somebody that could actually compete and not just use their background as a gimmick. He could actually produce in the ring, and he did.
Well, Bobby's told this story before. I'm going to get him to tell it again about the time he was refereeing a match between Patera and Bob Orton Jr.
Well, we were in Albany, and it was one of those deals where, you know, Orton Jr. was you know, he was, compared to Patera, he was a beanpole. So Orton would do the little deal. It was kind of a hit and run thing. He'd hit him and bail out of the ring, or he'd do a little something, bail out of the ring, you know, being the heel. And I can't remember what exactly happened, but I wound up on the floor with him fussing at him to get back in the ring. And Patera stomped his feet and screamed, "Let's wrestle." And Orton looked at me and goes, "He wants to wrestle." And I said, "Okay." So we climbed back in the ring, and Orton proceeded to tie him in a knot. And when he did, Patera was hollering, "Let's work." Yeah, it was... Orton Jr., not strong, but very smart, and what a wrestler. Jeez.
You know something strange about Patera? He was from Portland. His brother was the Seahawks football coach, and he never worked in that territory. Never had not one match there.
Hmm.
That is odd. Yeah, he made an appearance in Dothan one time. Rocky McGuire. I think he was in Georgia at the time, and he just went
right
and did a Saturday night or Friday night show.
Well, as Bo was mentioning about, you know, being that his hometown and never working there, I think, you know, we had discussed that with Jerry a little bit about sometimes hometowns can work against you, you know, and people just don't see as much of a big star sometimes as some other places you can work. And maybe that was the deal. I don't know, but it's interesting. You know, he was, I'm sure, packaged. Patera was, and he made a mistake, of course, in Wisconsin. That the he wanted to have it his own way in McDonald's, and ended up doing a couple of years in prison for it.
He probably was afraid to go home because he was afraid they'd team him up with the McGuire's.
He's got a daughter that works now that he sent to Harley Race and Harley trained her. Misty's worked with her a few times. She's really good. And, she moved to Kansas City to be close to Harley in his school there. She's been there for a few years.
Hmm. Well, in that same vein, you know, you've got the guys who are the bodybuilder types that they always built and so strong and you know, I don't know that. You know, I never was. I've seen him work, but I certainly never wrestled him. It was Billy Graham. And, you know, they built him up to be, you know, this big arm wrestler and all that. But that was usually a way of working into a gimmick where he'd be losing and turn the table over, whatever. I think he was the beginning of the bodybuilder type that were more show than actual strength. You guys tell me, you probably were around him a lot more than I was, or I wasn't around him at all, so.
Well,
I was only around him one time. That was in Atlanta.
When he first came in here after, you know, as Superstar Billy Graham, I don't know if he ever came in, you know, under his own name or earlier than that, but after doing extremely well in New York, they put him in a posing contest against Tony Atlas. And I've told the story, but at any rate, Doug Smith told me when we did it, they had the weights in the ring and they were going to do a pose, and the audience would clap and say who they liked doing the pose better. And then they were going to do some deals with the weights, and I thought for sure at the end Graham was going to turn the weights over on Atlas, but he didn't do it. But at any rate, that was the first time I saw him in Atlanta as Superstar Billy Graham, and he had, you know, already had the reputation. But not saying anything that no one else would believe, but he was certainly the super heel, and Tony Atlas was over as the babyface, and the crowd was behind Atlas. But that's what it was. It was looking at these guys doing these poses so they could show their muscles. And you're right, that was probably what he was as good at as anything else. I never thought, you know, he had the style for New York, and I never thought he had what you'd call the style that was going to go over simply as a worker any other places, but he made it on his reputation.
Well, you mentioned somebody else, Tony Atlas. I know they made a big deal about him bench pressing 550 pounds or something like that. They showed the clip on TV for months of him doing that at Doc's gym. What I used to say about Tony, and I never said it to his face, but the old saying, no pain, no gain, I used to say, no brain, no pain. But I know that they made him out to be strong, and I never worked with Tony. I saw him a few times, but never worked with him. Was he as legitimately strong as they made him out to be?
I saw him in my gym do reps with 500. I saw that myself. A lot of my guys in my gym packed their stuff and left when they saw him do it. They thought they were strong. I mean, 500 pounds is no joke.
Oh, I'll take your word for that, Jerry.
I got news for you. 200 pounds is no joke.
But I worked with Patera, and you know, I mean, when you hooked up with him, you could tell, you know. But he never tried his strength with you, you know. I mean, it'd been a joke, you know. He was so powerful. I mean, those guys like that they didn't. You know, and Tony, I worked with Tony. He was legit. I mean, he was strong. You know, But Patera, once in a while, you go to move him, and he would, like, flinch, you know, he'd start laughing. He, you know, just clowning with you, you know, but, oh, he was powerful. I mean,
I had a chance to wrestle Tony, and even with Tony, when you locked up with him, there wasn't no doubt, none, that he was strong. Before we get too far away, and in this same area, actually a little bit before Tony, a long time before Tony, and maybe Jerry can chime in on this one. A guy that was legitimately strong, but he did not look that strong. I mean, he wasn't, you know, super cut or anybody. He's a local guy from here in Atlanta, and that was Darrell Cochran.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't no joke either.
No, sir. Darrell was – he was into that – he was lifting – he was into that free weight, you know, the bar and the weights, long time before it became – you know, everybody was switching to the machines. He never did that. He kept working out with them free weights, and until he retired, after he retired from the fire department, man, he was a hoss.
Oh, he was avid about working out. I mean, he and Daryl was a good guy, you know.
Yes, he was.
Another guy to him. Go ahead, Bobby.
No, go ahead. I was just going to throw another name out there.
We may be talking about the same guy. When you were talking about Daryl, I didn't even think about Daryl, but somebody similar to him that, of course, he got heavier as his career went on, but he was a huge guy as far as chest and arm and everything, was Doug Gilbert.
Yeah. Well, there was a guy that came in here. I mean, he wrestled around, and we've talked about him with Joe Turner, and Joe Turner, you know, used to see. I wasn't around him that much. I refereed a few times with him in a ring, but the guy that used to use the Mr. Clean gimmick.
Ernie Bemis, yeah.
Now, he was legitimately strong. He would do those exhibition things where he would do things in a ring, you know, that were feats of strength. And, I mean, I seen him one time get in the ring and take a metal folding chair and him lay down on the mat and raise up and put his head on the seat of a folding chair, and he'd have somebody hold the back of the chair down on the mat where it wouldn't go forward, and he would reach back with his arms and grab the seat of that chair and pull himself completely off the ground with nothing but his neck on that chair. I mean, just feet straight out in the air. It was, so, you know, he was legitimately strong. But
I'll tell you how strong he wasn't, though.
Yeah, but well, legitimately, he was a bit of a goof, I think. But anyway, it's, you know.
The Beamus was a moron.
Yeah.
We were in Columbus. You know, the dressing room, Bobby, had a big white table in there?
Yeah.
Dromo's in there, right? Armstrong's in there. So here we go with that Dromo. He kept pumping Beamus about how strong Armstrong was. Now, Bemis had some arms on him. I don't think he did. And so he kept working Bemis up to arm wrestle Armstrong. He said, there's nobody can beat me in arm wrestling, blah, blah, blah. This went on and on, back and forth. So Armstrong finally got up and sat on those benches and put his arm up on the table. And he asked Bemis, he said, you want to do it left-handed or right-handed? He said, well, we'll do it right-handed first. Armstrong put him down. Then he put him down left-handed. I thought Bemis was going to start crying. But Dromo worked on this for 45 minutes.
I'm surprised Dromo didn't get him to bet some money.
I'm kind of surprised that Dromo would be involved in anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
I know you're taken back by it. I know you're taken back. And you know, remember those white slip-on shoes he wore?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Armstrong, I mean, Dromo hid those one night on him. You know, Bemis spent more time locked up than he did out on the street, I heard.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, too.
But after he left here, I never saw him again.
I didn't either.
He worked some in Florida. I'm not sure if it was before
he
came here.
Yeah, he was in Florida. I think he was in Florida in the mid-70s. They even put the Southern title on him.
Yep.
Briefly. And I think that was probably the last time I'd heard of him. It was there around 73, 74, somewhere in that time frame. Of course, he was probably 70 years old at that point.
Well, you know, there's also, I don't know if anybody ever pursued it or not, there's possibility that he could have gotten involved in a copyright infringement regarding his look and using the name that he did.
Well, they spelled the name different, how they
yes.
got around that. They spelled it K-L-E-E-N.
Yes.
And he wasn't the only Mr. Clean in the business. Ed Miller did that for a while. He was a Mr. Clean, and then... Of course, Ernie Roth used that name in the 60s as a manager, you know, with the shaved head and all this stuff, but he didn't wear the white outfit. Ed
right.
Miller did when he was Mr. Clean, but and of course, Bemis did. But I don't know. I think wrestling was so far off of the radar back then. I don't know that Procter & Gamble or whoever made Mr. Clean the product at that time would have even paid much attention to it.
Well, I think that's probably, as you said, being off the radar, that's probably what protected him.
But, you know, if they wanted to look for him now, they could probably go to the federal penal system and probably find him. I don't know what old Bemis had done, but I was kind of leery of him. You know, he wasn't a young man when I was around.
No.
I don't know where he come from or where he went. You know, that was the last I ever heard of him.
Well, he would have, before he became Mr. Clean, he was Brute Belkus for many years.
He was who?
Prior to that, Brute Belkus.
Well, did he work?
Texas, Indianapolis, maybe California. I don't remember where all, but he was the Brute before Brute Bernard did. You know, the shaved head and all that stuff. And then when he, you know, Brute Bernard kind of picked it up and was a bigger star than he was, that's when he became Mr. Clean, I think. I think he became Mr. Clean in the mid to late 60s. But he'd been around at least 10 or 12 years prior to that as Brute Belkus. But well, before we get too much further, we're at the halfway point of the show. It's time for another word from our sponsor, so I'm going to turn it over to Jay one more time.
Well, thank you very much. Here we go. The Peach State Pandemonium podcast is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. And if you sign up at our URL, which is audibletrial.com/GWHradio, you get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service.
You do that so well, I'm going to put you in for a raise.
Well, thank you very much. I need to get that one-month free trial.
Does it come with pictures? I mean, Charlie Smith may be interested in the pictures.
Yeah, because he certainly couldn't hear it, that's for sure.
Hey, one guy that we haven't talked about, I know everybody knows him, and he did the routine with the clubs, and that's the Iron Sheik.
Yeah.
I mean, you know that
who
was
else
his...
used to do that? And I'm sure Cosgrove really trained with that, but you know who the first person I ever saw do that? Tony Charles.
Well, those clubs aren't no joke.
No, they're not.
And he, Vasari.
I don't know how many guys at Atlanta TV in the dressing room nearly killed us after those things.
But Vasari had it down. I mean, man, he could do that. You know, he could keep it going, and it looked great.
It did. I just hate to have to haul him around everywhere like he did.
I was going to say, just moving him from the dressing room out on the set was a chore.
I saw him get in a big dispute with a promoter in West Virginia where they flew him in, and he brought the clubs, and it was, I don't remember how much extra for the clubs to go on the plane. And the guy's telling him, I never told you to bring them. Well, I have to. They go everywhere I go.
Well, I find that really hard to believe that he got into a dispute with somebody.
Listen, when he first got to Georgia, when he first came in, he was Olympic wrestler.
Yes.
You know, had the reputation of being tough, and we were doing interviews on Tuesday, and this was after Freddie had left, and I was doing the Tuesday interviews over there that, you know, made the cycle. So we're sitting there and we're getting ready to do an interview, and he was sitting in a chair that had wheels on it up against the wall, and he went to sleep, and he leaned it, and his head fell back, and the chair went out from under him, and he hit the ground. He busted the back of his head. He's got blood running down, and we're all standing there, and everybody in the room is wanting to laugh, but nobody will laugh. So we're sitting there and we're watching, and he finally started laughing, and when he did, it was like the tension in the room. It was like somebody letting the air out of a tire. It just, everybody fell apart, but wouldn't nobody laugh till he laughed.
You know, Bobby tells that like he didn't have anything to do with that chair. He did the same thing to Sonny King.
Oh.
Bobby gimmicked that chair where everybody sat in, it would fall out of it.
Oh.
Well,
now, I went to interview, this ain't got nothing to do with strongmen, but I went to do an interview with Buzz Sawyer. Y'all might not believe this about Buzz. We're going to do an interview, and he told me, he said, I'm going to do something. And he said, when I do it, he said, you just don't say nothing. I said, all right. So we started the interview, and he said, well, here's what I think about it. And he turned around, and he dropped his drawers and mooned the camera.
Oh.
Now, Ronnie West comes screaming out of the back. Boy, he was screaming and yelling, and I'm standing there, and he looked at me, and I said, I did not know what he was going to do. And he jumped all over. He called him offside, just chewed him out. They had that thing piped into all the TVs all throughout the building.
Ooh.
You know, people, guests come into the lobby, were watching us do interviews. So, needless to say, that was one of them deals where Barnett got a phone call.
Well, one strong man's name hasn't come up that's a favorite of all of us, and that's the mighty Zulu.
You know, I was tempted to put him on my list, and then I said, no, if somebody else brings him up, go for it.
He couldn't bust an egg.
You couldn't prove by me he could pick a dozen eggs up.
Like I said, that cape of his was the main attraction.
Oh, jeez.
I wonder what he fed that thing.
He had shoulders 4 foot wide. He had a big set of arms, and his legs looked like somebody that had laid up in the bed for 6 months and they had atrophied.
Well,
I mean, they were awful.
Same thing with Tony Atlas and Art Thomas were the same way. Had no calf muscle whatsoever.
None.
Rick Root was that way. That's why he wore his knee pads backwards.
Yeah.
I'm glad these guys aren't around, you know, to possibly take some type of affront at this, but it's our show.
Right. They want to rebut. They know what Bobby
did. Hey, listen. I promise you, those statements were the absolute truth.
Well, sure.
I mean, that's just, you know, there's no slander or malice intended. That's just a statement of fact.
That's right. The truth has set us free.
Yes.
You talk about Zulu's cape. I often wonder which Mongol he stole that from whenever they were in the ring and he was in the dressing room.
I always wanted to ask him if the shots were up to date on the cape.
We're talking about somebody that's deceptively strong, at least in my opinion. I mean, he was well built. He was extremely athletic. You could tell by looking at him. But I would have thought he was as powerfully strong as he was Bob Backlund. The reason I say that is he did a spot in a lot of his matches that just, to this day, just amazes me because there's no way that it can be a work. Whoever he was wrestling with would eventually get him in a short arm scissors. He'd roll to his knees, get to his feet, and lift the guy straight up with one arm. And there's no way the guy holding on to that short arm can help him.
No, but that's cheap there.
I've seen him do it with Ivan Koloff and Sergeant Slaughter, big guys, too.
Yep,
yeah.
Exactly.
I tell you, another one like that is Bill Eadie. He was a strong man.
Yep.
I've seen him slam Andre. I mean, even if Andre's going with you, you still got to get him up there and hold him.
Yep. I tell you, somebody else who I saw not only slam Andre, but suplex him, there again, and a deceptively strong guy, was Harley Race.
Don't think he wasn't strong.
And me.
I never saw Harley do a push-up.
No. I give you another guy, and this is Bo's real familiar with this guy right up in that part of the world up there was Archie Goldie.
But
I don't know, Bo. You probably know this better than me. I know Knoxville TV. Archie, when George Jr. was managing, did the concrete block bust on his head. And then they did it with Joe LaDuke, and Joe wound up in the hospital. I never knew whether that was a shoot or not.
It almost killed him. He was in intensive care for 3 days. When Archie swung the hammer, George knew how to do it. And they wanted Archie to do it, and Archie told them he didn't feel comfortable doing it. And they said, no, we want you to take the hammer out of Gigi's hand, and you do it. He did, and it went all the way through the block and hit LaDuke in the head. And I mean, he just—I've actually—I've got the video up. I mean, he just starts shaking. He goes into convulsions and just falls over. And it was a big news story because they were on live TV. They had to stop the taping. You know, they come back, had to show tapes. And he was in the hospital for a week, intensive care for 3 days. So, and what a return! You ever heard the story how he returned?
No.
Archie in the Coliseum on a Friday night. Gorgeous George Jr. and Stomper working over Ron Fuller, and Joe LaDuke comes through the front door and starts walking down the steps. And they're, you know, just slowly, and then the people see it, and they start standing. By the time he got to the floor, everybody in the building was on their feet. He gets to the ring, they run, he gets the stick, says, "I'm back." And off to the races they went.
Huh. That crazy actor, Jones, for those of you that were around, that wasn't no act with him.
No.
I've told this before. The most scared I've ever been in my life, in the wrestling business, out of the wrestling business, in the circus business, out of it, the most scared I have ever been in my life was riding from Pensacola, Florida to Birmingham, Alabama in a van with Joe LaDuke and the Sheepherders.
Could you imagine being stopped with that crew? I mean, you know, and those guys jump out. No.
Let me tell you, I'd have been thankful to have been stopped. I'd have gone with the police.
Yeah, Joe get a little bit of that liquid medication and some of that herbal medication,
absolutely.
Buddy.
All
he was, them eyes get real big. That way, they, you know, they couldn't help but get big.
Oh, man. He was a character, I tell you. Nice guy, but ooh.
You know, there was a lot of guys in our business that did not look strong, but you know, my buddy Rocket Monroe, you hook up with Rocket, it was like hooking up with a fire plug. I mean, he was solid as a rock. Gene Anderson
looked like dinosaurs. Yeah,
Gene Anderson. He had the strongest. Other than Danny Hodge, Gene Anderson had the strongest fingers and hands anybody ever met in my life.
Well, you know, guys that have that type of strength, you know, usually are working type guys, and you don't think of them as being bodybuilders and things like that, but they've just got that strength in their hands because they've worked, and some of them were just unbelievable. Hodge was one I was going to mention because Mike likes to talk about him, and he, you know, that was the deal he would do when he would come out and come into an area would be to crush the apple. But, It's unbelievable what kind of strength those guys had. It just, you know, not saying that they weren't strong other places, but just in their hands. I mean, how they could just tear you apart.
Well, you mentioned the working type guys. You guys remember Jim McKinney?
Yep.
Wasn't he a bricklayer or something? He was
a brick mason. He sure was. Me and Larry Nichols talked him into going in the ring. We were standing behind the camera. We talked him into going in the ring. He broke Timmy Gahagan's sleeper hole. The first time he did it, Gahagan said he wasn't ready, so they did it a second time, and he broke it again. Ernesto's eyes got about as big as saucers. Then they got McKinney off to the side and put a bug in his ear, and he went on TV the next week and said, "I'm giving the $1,000 check back to the retired wrestler's home, and they're going to train me to wrestle."
Right.
And they made Gahagan train him.
I got a cut of that money. You didn't get that money.
Well, you know, I saw Timmy put that sleeper hold on very quickly on a couple of guys there that, you know, that came out there. And, you know, they were out like lights very, very, very quickly. And a lot of folks thought that sleeper hold was not legit. But if you knew what you were doing with it, you could put somebody out real fast.
Oh, and guys would pee their pants. I mean, you lost all control. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like going in a coma or something. Yeah, boy, it was awful.
Yeah,
I had him to put me to sleep in America's Georgia in the dressing room.
Why would you want him to do that, Jerry?
I just want to see what it felt like. I went out like a 40-watt bulb.
That's like saying somebody would say, you know, it really feels interesting if you put your finger in that wall socket. But I can't imagine anybody just doing that just to see what it felt like. But
well,
okay.
He put it on me one night. We weren't in a ring. I had the privilege to wrestle with him. I wrestled him one night, but I had him put it on me, and I told him, I said, "Now don't put me out. I just want to see what, you know." It kind of feels like you're being sucked into a vacuum. It's like everything's just going away from you. It was to
exactly.
me. And, buddy, yep. you're gone. It's over.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry, I guess it's a good thing you were never on a car with Dr. Sam Shepard. You'd have had him sticking his finger down your throat.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I would have.
That sounded like.
I always, you know, I'm the type of person, you know, I always want to say, you know, through my walk of life, I've been there and done that, you know. But you talking about powerful guys, one of the most powerful guys.
Do
I? Nah, I don't know if he ever worked out. I maybe did at one time. Was Sweet Hansen. Now, that was a powerful man.
He looked like he was.
He was, oh, you yeah. can't imagine. You can't imagine. I know in Charlotte, Wahoo and Jardine got in a fight, and that's who broke it up, was Sweet.
There again, that's two people I'd have never thought would have had the temperament to get in a fight. Wahoo McDaniel and Don Jardine.
Well, and Sweet Hansen was, you know, looking at him, he wasn't the guy that was going to be concerned about if his face got messed up a little bit if he got into a bad fight, you know. So, yeah, he was scary looking, and he was a big guy.
He was huge, big bone man.
Didn't he own a bar there in Charlotte, Jerry?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
He didn't need to hire a bouncer, did he?
No, sir. Sweet. He was a nice guy, too. We traveled with him some. He was a nice guy. I like Sweet.
Well, a name just popped into my head that looked powerful. I don't know whether he was or not. That's Charlie Tanaka.
Oh, come on, man.
He did the thing with breaking the bricks and all that stuff. But.
Oh, he was a freak, man. He was, listen, he told me a story. He come out of the gym one day, and he was telling me he'd wrestle in the Boston Gardens. And they used to go, he said, we'd go down the fire escape out the back, you know. And he always carried his nunchucks over his bag. The nicest man you ever want to meet, you know. Not looking for any trouble. So he said he comes down the steps and gets down there in the parking lot. He says five Puerto Rican guys there waiting on him. They said, "Hey, big man, we saw what you did in there. We don't like what you did. You know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that." And so they kept on. So he said, "I just set my bag down." And he said, this one guy kept running his mouth. He said, "Look, what I do in there, you know, I make my living doing that. I don't want no trouble out here." So this guy just kept running his mouth. So he's reached down and got those nunchucks. He said, "I knew I was going to get him first." He said he come across those nunchucks and laid them right across his collarbone and come back across the other way and caught the other guy, and the other threes were gone by now.
I bet. You know, anybody that much of an idiot deserved whatever they got. You know, I mean, that's why? Why would anybody even think they could
do something? I don't know. And then there was a guy at the gym. He said, he was in there just talking, just a nice guy. You know, this one, we had this black kid in there. He said, "Oh, man, I don't think you're really that tough." I said, "You better watch your mouth now. Don't be starting nothing in there." He kept on and on. He said, so he told him, he said, "I'll tell you what you do." He said, you go on and choke me. I want you to choke me. You ever see his neck? Like a telegraph pole.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He said, "I want you to choke me." He said, I'll never forget this guy's name. His name was Charles. He said, "Man, I'll put you on the ground." He said, "All right, go ahead and you choke me, and we'll see what happens." So he was kind of leery to do it. So he finally walked up to him. He started choking him. He just kept carrying on a conversation with me and my brother like he wasn't even standing there. He's trying to dig his thumbs in his, Adam's apple in his throat. Didn't even faze him. I mean, he was when he was in the military, he taught all kind of stuff. He was at Fort Benning at one time. Nice man. Yeah, you talking about a dangerous joker? Strong.
was somebody in that similar vein. And
well, wait a minute. Let me throw something in there. I'll tell you when he's not so tough. When Fuji puts the marijuana in his skull, and he sits in the dressing room and he ties a kite and the bell rings and you have to tell him to come to the ring.
Oh.
You remember when they did the deal where Wrestling 2 had to have the neck surgery and they did deal where Tanaka and then
yes.
they come out. We're in Athens working a return, man, and these people are hanging from the rafters, man.
Of course.
That place is just packed. And I'm in the ring refereeing, and they're doing a thing, and Charlie's getting his heat. And all of a sudden, there's another guy in the ring. I turn around, and there's a mark in there.
Oh.
And the mark come by Charlie. I thought he was after him, and he went by Charlie, and he come at me. And I'm hollering at Charlie, Charlie, Charlie. And Charlie thought he was posing for a karate magazine. He started going, ah, ah, and making all these noise doing his stuff. And the guy's steady coming at me. And I wound up backing up into a corner, and I kicked the guy, and he went down. Charlie finally grabbed him, but I thought, God, quit posing and hit this guy.
That's a dangerous man, I'm telling
yes,
you.
Yes, it was.
Somebody similar to that man, he even built similar to him, was Saito. Huh. But I don't know how strong he was, because, I mean, all the times I wrestled him, he was light as a feather. But I know he could suplex. You could be laying flat on your stomach, and he could suplex you. I watched.
He's the first guy in the business to knock me out.
He was very quick in the ring. Very, very quick.
Yes.
You know, he went to the Olympics.
Yeah, he was silver medalist in 68.
Yeah, he knocked me out in Bells Lee, Florida.
Well, you shouldn't have been so stiff, Jerry.
Yeah, right.
But I saw him one night in Birmingham. He'd worked with Armstrong or somebody, and he was headed back to the dressing room. And, of course, everybody's standing up, and I'm sitting at the ringside table. And so I can't really see what's going on because he was so short. Once, you know, people were standing up on their chairs. But somehow somebody hit him or something. Next thing I know, this guy that hit him, his feet were in the air. So he took it, picked him up and suplexed around that concrete and just kept moving. Did it all in one move and just kept moving. He was something else, too.
He made the trip with me and Ole when we did the Sheik thing with Parkersburg and Huntington, and we were in Huntington, and we had went to eat, and we were in the car. Ole had met this young lady he was talking to, and they're standing out behind the car, and all of a sudden Ole is screaming to the top of his lungs at this girl, and all these lights start coming on in these houses, and Saito turns and looks at me and goes, "We're going to jail." And I went, "No, we're not. I have the keys. We're fixing to leave."
He's the one that was with Patera, right?
Yes, he was.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, they said they stashed those cops up like cold wood.
Oh, yeah.
I just cannot imagine. Well, Bo, who, I've been sitting here this whole show trying to think of somebody that was, other than Zulu, who worked in Gulas there for a while. Who, was there anybody up that way that was a big
Doug Furness
type of a... Doug Furness.
Doug Furness had 18 world records.
Who did?
Doug Furness.
Yeah, Furness was strong, yeah.
He had the biggest legs I ever seen, too, 38 inches round thighs.
He was a football player. Didn't he play for University of Tennessee? Football?
University of Tennessee for the great Johnny Majors.
Now, I think the Mobile territory had some strong boys, the Fullers and the Welches, wasn't they? That was a joke, guys.
Well, I wasn't going to, jump in there. I was.
There you go, talking about our Tennessee heroes again.
I'm sorry, sir. They never. I don't even know if they even drove by a gym. Let's let go in one.
That's a quote right there that start your book. That belongs in there. Don't even know if they drove by the gym.
Well, I have changed. You know, everybody refers to the bathroom as the John. I have changed mine to the gym, and that way I can tell everybody I went to the gym this morning.
I like that, Bobby Summers. I knew you'd get in there eventually.
Well,
I think another guy they had here, Michael, he worked underneath here before with Carl Stiles. He was a pretty strong guy. You know, he was, when he first started, he was about probably 350, 360, and then he got down to about 280 and just, you know, just cut up. He was
Didn't
another
he do a German gimmick or something like that, or a Russian gimmick?
Yeah,
Carl
at
Stiles
one time, and then he was he did a hillbilly in Portland, Oregon. He was a Tennessee hillbilly out there, and he's from.
Had only one eye, right?
Yeah, they did the thing in Portland where Lynn didn't pull his glass eye out. Yeah.
Well,
imagine how Don and Elton Owens thought when we saw that on their TV.
Well, they may have thought in Portland that that's the way all the Tennessee hillbillies look. Yeah.
Hey, they got hillbillies in Portland, Oregon. Let me tell you, I've been out there.
Let me tell you this, and it's got nothing to do with nothing, but I've met more rednecks in New Jersey than I ever met in Mississippi.
Well, that's a true thing. Yeah.
But,
I tell you, another group of guys, is all of them, you know, and you wouldn't really think it's looking at some of them, but all them Islanders, them Samoans and Fijians and Tongans.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, those boys ain't nothing to fool with now.
Half of the sequel were no joke at all. In fact, you know how they got the business, don't you?
Beating the cops up in the Cow Palace.
Exactly. And Roy Shire told Peter Mavia, he said, "Spark them boys up."
They said Pat Patterson used to look, see if they were sitting ringside. If they were sitting ringside, he wouldn't go to the ring.
Oh, man.
That hot
two of the nicest guys you ever want to meet.
Hey, you know, they make up, I saw this on ESPN a couple years ago, and I can't, it's not even 1% of the population of the world. I mean, it's less than 1%. But, you know, they have, every NFL team has a Samoan, at least one. And they got them professional boxers now getting in the UFC. There's several baseball players that are Samoans, but they can do anything. Run, jump, swim, hit, wrestle, fight.
What was the policeman that wrestled up there in East Tennessee that lost his leg?
Ed Wolf.
Wasn't he real strong?
Yeah. He was, and they were just getting him where he was ready to start going out, get booked out. He'd only been working, I don't know, it wasn't a real long time, maybe a year. And he just took, you know, got thrown out of the ring. They left a wood chair at ringside. Somebody put it there to step up in the ring. He went out and hit it. The wood broke, went all the way through his leg. And they went and took it out, did surgery, but it didn't take. He got gangrene. They had to take it off at the hip. I just always wondered if he would have had that, if that same injury would have come along years later, would he have been able to save the leg with the changes in medicine and everything.
Right.
There was another guy. I never saw him wrestle. I've seen pictures of him, and I've seen listings of him, but I knew him on a different level. Guy that worked in Tennessee, former pro football player named Big Daddy Holmes. He's probably before your time. Well, I don't know that you would have ever seen him.
Yeah,
I know. He was my football coach in high school. He looked like Frankenstein's monster. That was huge. In fact, I got in trouble. I got caught. I drew a picture of the football team. I did a cartoon of the football team with him facing us. All you could see was his back and his upper back and his shoulders and his head, and I had bolts sticking out of his neck. And he found that picture, and he looked at it, and he acted like he was going to get mad, but he actually laughed at it. He was a character. He always said he was a wrestler, and I never believed him until somebody sent him, I started seeing his name in results after I was grown and everything, and I came across some pictures of him when he was in Oklahoma. I don't know what everybody had. As far as I know, he was still coaching it when I graduated high school, so I don't know if he was still in Mobile, alive, dead, or what, but he was huge.
Here's one. How strong was Andre?
I don't know if anybody, I don't even know if Andre.
I don't know if anybody knows.
Yeah.
When I first met him in 74, you know, after I came to work for Barnett and he came through in December, you know, and that's the first time I'd met him. And when I first, he was legitimately 7'4" and probably about 500 pounds then. He was huge. He was huge. And, of course, as time went on, he got heavier and he got shorter.
Right.
Yeah.
But when I first met him, he was a monster. I weighed about, in the whole time I was in the wrestling business, from the time I started to the time I got out, I never weighed over 240 pounds. I'd go from 220 to 240. I'd fluctuate, but I stayed right in that area. And we did a deal. Me and him got this little deal where he would be in the ring, and I would go to stop him from doing something, and he would take me over to a corner, and he would pick me up and set me on the top rope. He'd turn to walk away. I'd jump down. He'd turn around and look at me, and I'd flat foot back up on the top rope and sit down again. But when he would pick me up and put me on the top rope, it didn't matter if I helped him or not. I was going up there and sat down. So, I mean, I don't know if anybody legitimately knows how strong he was or not. I've heard stories that he turned the Volkswagen over one night when some guys were aggravating him. I don't know. I wouldn't have wanted to found out if he got mad.
Yeah.
Well, he just touched me with his index finger one night at the Omni where we did a deal where I've told it before where he wanted to go into the cage and, you know, I was telling him, no, on the mic now, no, Andre, you can't go into the cage. And so he just touched me with his index finger and I sold it, of course, like would I not? And so at any rate, but it felt like you were touching me with a pipe, you know, so I could just imagine how much strength this guy had. I mean, it just the unbelievable size. And yes, as Bobby said, by that time he was much, much larger. I mean, just obviously a giant, but just unbelievable when you stand that close to him. I mean, you see him back sitting at ringside, or you know, even where I would sit there next to the ring, but just being within 6 inches from him as he would do something like that, it was scary, no doubt about it.
And I never saw anybody drink as much as he could drink, and I never saw him even tipsy.
Well, I heard a lot of stories about his drinking.
He was notorious for drinking, but I never saw him tipsy.
You know, Billy Crystal tells a story about him during his drinking days when they were making that movie, and they were in a hotel, and they rolled him up in a big rug, you know, and he just collapsed there, and you know, and so they didn't want to leave him there, so because he wasn't going to get up for a while, so they just rolled him up. But obviously when he would drink his fill, he was going to be asleep for a while.
Hey, here's two for Jerry. Jerry got to work with them when they first started, the Road Warriors.
Oh my God!
I'm glad I got to know them after they got with it.
They weren't as bad as I thought they were going to be, but you talking about strong, both of them. But they. You know, for as big as they were and as green as they were, they, you know, they'd listen. You know, they were a lot better than I thought they'd be. The Hawk was the mean one. He was the bad one. I'll never forget Nick Patrick told a story that wrestled in Columbus on a Wednesday night. They went back to the final and Nick was driving. I don't know who was in the front with him, but the Hawk was sitting in the back. They went to D. Ford's there in Atlanta. And Nick said they passed by the sidewalk. He said, there's seven or eight guys. Oh, man, no, he just stopped the car. Asked all those guys, what me? Nobody fess up to who said it. He didn't take no jump. None.
He rode with me a couple of weeks in Tennessee. When they'd sent him, he got hurt, and they'd send him back down to get ready to go back to New York. He was down there working with us, and he'd ride with me and Bulldog Range. He always wanted to buy our food. He said, look, boys, I know what I'm making. I'm knowing what you're making. Let me take care of you. You know, he was just, I thought a lot of him.
He was a good guy. He was.
I talked to him on the phone the day he died. I talked to him on the phone.
I hate he got all my stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Listen, you were talking about Sweet Hansen earlier. Terry Gordy was another one. Probably
yeah.
Never lifted a weight in his life. But just was naturally just, what was the old thing that they used to say about Sweet Hansen, raw bone? But Gordy was another one.
He was another one as an animal. Dr. Death Steve Williams.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I never saw him work live, but I saw a lot of tapes of him. That guy was unbelievable.
He was a heck of a football player, I know that.
And his final days were not fun.
No.
No,
he suffered.
Well, Jerry, I know you wrestled him. How strong was Ernie Ladd?
Ernie, you know, he Ernie, sort of, you know, you just, I never thought too much about that, really. I mean, because Ernie could do anything. He could head scissor, drop kick, everything. I just pictured Ernie as just a big guy, you know. I'm sure he was powerful. I mean, he had to have been as big as he was, but I never pictured him like that.
Playing in the NFL, I'm sure he was strong.
Oh, he was.
But when he got in the wrestling business, I mean, you sometimes, I mean, I don't know how he was with you. I'm sure he was the same way. At times, you'd have to tell him, you know, Ernie, you know, tighten up a little bit. Let me know you're there.
He was so light.
There was times he didn't know he was there.
Yeah, really. That's a good way of putting this. I mean, for a man that size, I mean, you never felt uncomfortable. You know, some of these guys you felt uncomfortable with. You didn't, you know, they, like Moose Sherlock, for example. But,
I wondered when anything would come up.
You knew I was going to get around to it, didn't you? But Ernie, yeah, you didn't. It was like wrestling a guy your size. You just didn't think nothing about Ernie. Yeah. Like Bobby said, I mean, he's light as a feather.
Yeah, that's very true, because I can remember watching Ladd, big, tall, lanky guy, and, you know, his personality was what it was. But I can remember now seeing him work with guys, and it was obvious that his punches were, you know, were not really connecting.
He wouldn't hurt you for nothing.
No, he wouldn't.
Ernie would take care of you. You know, he was, I always felt comfortable working with him. Never felt uneasy.
Sort of like working with Hans Schmidt.
Oh, my God. I'd like to run into him one more time. He's probably about 90 now. I think I could take him.
He died a couple of years ago. Hans did.
Another guy that Bill Bowman and Joe Turner talked about how incredibly strong he was. Never had a chance to meet him, but it was a guy up around the Carolinas. Bo, you may know about him, Luther Lindsay.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about him.
Well, they said he's a freak, too.
Yeah. That's what I, you know. They, you know, Bowman tells the story when he died. The old man Crockett told him, he said, you know, the baby faces can go by the funeral home from this hour to this hour, and the heels can go from this hour to this hour. And Joe and Bill went by there, and they said there wasn't nobody there but them. And he said Joe went through and he looked and he signed the book and he walked out and said he heard Bill going, "Joe, come here quick, come here." And said he went in there and said Bill was laying across the casket. And he told Joe, he said, "Quick, count him out." He said, "I want to cover him just one time before he goes."
I wonder what he's done. Luther would have jumped up out of there.
Ooh.
Oh,
Jerry was mentioning mentioning about how old somebody might be and whether they were still around or not. Anybody got an idea of who the oldest living professional wrestler of our era is that's still around?
Well, it's not so bold anymore. He died last year. He was 103 or 101
My guess would be Gypsy Joe.
Well, the name's not on the list. The oldest name listed on the list, and this is once again from the Wrestling News, is Cora Combs, who's 91 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
She was at Scott's last year at the reunion up there.
Yeah. Yes, she is. Just about every year to Scott's.
Yeah.
And listed next to that is Bob Geigel at 89.
Wow, we don't.
Al Green is 86, Lord Littlebrook 85, Pampero Furpo and El Mongo at 84, and Lynn Rossi, Tom Drake, and Don Leo Jonathan at 83, Dick Byer, Danny Hodge at 82, and Rene Gallet, Gene LaBelle, and Stan Nielsen at 81. But at any rate, the Cora Combs is listed as the oldest named wrestler, you know, somebody that was actually on the bill in semi or main events at 91 years of age.
I'll be dumb.
Joe has a different age every time that you ask him. He has a different age, but, you know, a lot of the boys, you know, swear that he's up around that 90 to 92 mark. People that's known him for many years, it would know.
Yeah.
I've known him for 25 years, and he's never got older than 72 in the 25 years that I've known him. So.
Going back away, back to the 50s, did they ever really, I know they built up his football reputation, how mean he was and how dangerous he was and everything, but did they ever really build Bruiser as somebody super strong? I know he and Crusher together were supposed to be the Road Warriors of their day. But
I was around the Bruiser when he, but I never wrestled him. You talking about the Bruiser?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was around him, but I never wrestled him. I don't know.
You know, he died lifting weights.
Yeah.
And yeah, he was in Florida, he lived.
He was, drew a ton of money, I know that. Heard the Warriors talking.
Michael, what was the guy's name that Gagne, he was in the Olympics, great big guy that Gagne broke in, he died young.
Chris Taylor, yeah.
I couldn't think of his name.
He was my riding partner when he spent 2 weeks in Georgia. I hauled him around everywhere he went. Nice guy.
He was out of his element.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen pictures of him. I don't think I ever saw any kind of video of him in the ring.
Not being cruel, you didn't miss nothing.
Yeah, he probably never, I don't know if he was ever on TV other than maybe just to look at, but yeah, he was.
Well, he got some coverage on Wild World of Sports, and, you know,
I've seen video of him and his opponent is a 300-pound, dark-haired Ric Flair.
Well, Taylor, right after his Olympic work, he, you know, Wide World of Sports covered him, and he was one of the reasons that Wide World of Sports was willing to give the Ali Baba fight the coverage they did was because of a couple of those guys that were around. Dan Gable was another one, and Chris Taylor was you know, he wasn't cut out for the professional wrestling business, but he had a little bit of reputation from the Olympics, and I think Vern Gagne really wanted to push him, and so he did what he did. But he certainly, in my opinion, was not cut out for the professional wrestling business, and it showed.
Well, I'll tell you a guy I gained a great deal of respect for, and I never met him or never laid eyes on him, and that was the Russian guy that suplexed him and beat him in the Olympics. Because Chris wasn't no little fella.
Oh, no.
And that guy,
Chris stayed in the business.
Yeah, they said that guy, they said the guy that that did it, they said he injured his back, and, you know, he won the gold medal, but he never, that was the end of his career because he hurt his back doing it, but he went behind him and hooked him in souple. That's a, I gained a whole new respect for that fella.
Let's see, Chris was in the, that was the 72 Olympics, right? Same as Patera. Jerry, you asked how long he was in the business. I'd say maybe 3-4 years tops.
Yeah, I only saw, only time I ran across him was in Kansas City. You went there long.
Yeah, he came here for two weeks. That was it.
Well, there really wasn't much you could do from? With him. I want to say diabetes, but I'm not sure.
Probably.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's it.
But they turned him heel and he grew a beard to cover up those warts and everything that he had on.
You know what they call those sweat glands? You know, those little sweat.
Yeah.
Things he had them all over.
Yeah. What was he, about 6'5", 6'6", 450 pounds, something like that? He was
he's a monster.
Yeah, he's a big old fella.
From Iowa. There's another one, an Iowa farm boy. It was real, he's, I guess, strong.
He probably pulled plows as a young boy or something.
Yeah, he probably did. I wonder if he ever crossed paths with Ox Baker. Ox was from Iowa.
Where is he living now?
Connecticut.
Who, Ox?
Last I heard.
Yeah.
He's in New Jersey,
where?
Isn't he?
No, Connecticut.
Connecticut, that's it. Yeah, Connecticut.
Doing what?
Well, you know, he worked
at Walmart greeter.
He did work at Walmart, yeah, for a month. So they caught him selling autographed pictures and they fired him.
I'm sorry, but I would hate to be the personnel manager that had to tell Locke Baker, you're fired. Even that,
well,
however old he is, he's still scary looking.
Let me tell you something about Ox. Ox was not a tough man.
No.
No.
At all. I caught that big goof going in my wrestling bag one night, and I told Locke all about his getting tape out of my bag. I said, hey, Ox, they sell that stuff, pal. Oh, I just needed some. I was out. He took a, he used to wrap his fist.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well,
I saw him. I saw the rerun of him on Price is Right not too long ago on the Game Show Network.
Was he trying to sell pictures there or what?
They contacted him about coming to Mobile to the Gulf Coast reunion, and he said the only way he would come is if he could sell his gimmicks. And I, of course,
who's he
going
to sell them to?
Well, they don't let you sell stuff down there, but I told him, I said, y'all should have told him, well, come on, you can sell anything you want. I said, because ain't nobody, who would have bought him?
Nobody.
Nobody. Now, I'll tell you something he did back, it's about 1973, I guess. He got into this deal where he was, he would go to these coin stores and he would buy these silver dollars. And he would buy the necklace holders that you could insert the coin in. He'd clean the coins up, then he'd put them in the holders and he would put put a chain in there, and he was selling them. I think he was selling them for $10-$12 back in. I bought two or three of them, but the silver dollars are worth, you know, $22 now. So you know, it was a good investment. But yeah, he was peddling jewelry back then.
Him and Frazier
gone
together.
In business with, yeah, I was going to say him and Frazier could have gone in together.
Yeah, with the watch, you'd need to buy a watch. If he, you know, the only thing about Ox was clumsy. He to this day, he hit me harder than any human being has ever hit me in my life. And, you know, he just... He would, you know, Bill and Joe said they was in a six-man tag with him one night. They was his partners, and he said they got beat to death standing on the apron.
He had one of the best looks, though.
Oh, yes. And, of course, he had the reputation because of the heart punch and a couple of guys that died after matches with him.
Gary, who do you think the strongest guy through the wrestling in your gym and bodybuilding, all the stuff, who do you think the strongest guy you've ever come across is?
Me?
Yeah.
Wrestler or non-wrestler?
Yeah.
Eddie Cohn. He's 242-pound world-class powerlifter. And at one time, he was the strongest man in the world. He was at my gym. A doctor called me from Griffin, Georgia, said Eddie Cohn was coming to Columbus. His girlfriend was going to go to Houston Clinic. He said, do you care if he comes in there and does deadlifts? I said, no, sir. I said, I got a gym. I don't have a spa. He can do anything he wants. He comes in there. So he said he was getting ready to go to a meet in Las Vegas. And I introduced myself. I said, feel free to do whatever you want here. I said, I don't care what you do. He said, okay. So anyway, he went in there after he warmed up. He put 850 pounds on a bar. He did 8 reps of deadlifts with it. He looked like a machine doing it. And he did some other stuff. And when he got through, he come up to the counter. I made him a protein shake. He took the shirt off he had on and signed it. And he put Eddie Cohn. 8 reps for 850 pounds, and he signed it and gave it to me. And I said, you know what? I said, I've been an athlete all my life, and I said, I've been around a lot of different ball players. I said, we had a lot of pro football players that worked out in there, pro baseball players. And I said, I've been around a lot of athletes. And I said, you know, you're one of the nicest guys I've ever met. You know, he wasn't cocky. He wasn't arrogant. He was... You know, he was a world-class lifter. You know what he told me? He said, I'm just a guy that lifts weights. The most humble guy to be that powerful. Anyhow, I asked him, I said, what are you going to do when you go to Vegas? He said, well, he said, I'm not a very strong bencher. He said, I'll get 600. I'm going, right, 600 is not very strong. He said, I'm going to squat 1,000. No. Yeah, he said, I'm going to squat 1,050 and deadlift 950.
Good grief.
Anyway, 242 pounds. That's a good question. That's the strongest man I've ever seen.
Yeah. Where was he from?
He was from Chicago. You can look him up, Eddie Cohn.
Yeah, I'm going to look him up. I never heard of him. See, the weights he's lifting is impressive. I mean, that stands alone for itself. But
I've been around guys. You know, I mean, I've been around all kind of guys in my life. You know, through working out in different parts of the country and overseas. But to see a guy pick up he didn't have on a belt. No straps, wraps, nothing. And, the eighth rep looked just like the first one. He didn't drop it. He didn't bang it. He controlled it. And I asked him, I said, have you ever, you know, hurt yourself doing this? He said, I've never hurt myself in my life. And he said, you're not built for this. I said, well, I know that, you know, my height. Because he was like, I don't even believe he was 5'8". Thick, and he took his shirt off, and I mean, he looked like a bodybuilder that was not ready for a contest, you know, needed to lose some weight. But, I mean, you could see the abs in his stomach. He had, I mean, not bulging arms, but, I mean, he was just, that was I still talk about him to this day, and I'm glad you mentioned that because he deserves to be mentioned. I've never seen anybody that strong ever, never ever.
You ain't ever been with me to the Smoky Pig Barbecue in Columbus, Georgia. I can do some reps with that pork over there, son.
Is that some good stuff?
Oh, jeez.
Are they going to knock us off the air,
Mike? I go see my kids before I go to their house. That's the first place I go.
I'm going to tell you something. Not because I'm from Columbus, Georgia. Columbus, Georgia's got some of the best barbecue in this world.
Amen, brother. Without a doubt.
They always talk about the barbecue in Kansas City. Kathy and Ted and I went to a barbecue place. It was supposed to be the hottest thing out there. We went out there, and we almost cried. It was like eating I don't know what it was. I told them, I said, they don't know what barbecue is.
Well, I tell people, I don't make no bones about it. They ask me my favorite place in the world to eat, and I tell them it's the Smoky Pig. It's just a little hole in the wall. You know, the one in Phoenix City is a little bigger, but that one I go to, the one over there, wasn't too far from your gym. Mm.
Yeah, you just can't believe it. They got some great places there.
Well, guys, our time is up. In fact, we're already into overtime mode. But next week, and Bo, I hope you are able to join us, because next week we're going to follow up on something we touched on last week. Scott Teal is going to be our guest, and we're going to talk about the Welch family and the Dyersburg, Tennessee area, and all the guys that came out of that area. So
that'll be 2 hours y'all talking about our Tennessee heroes.
No, Scott will defend them. That's why I'm saying you can join us.
We'll still be outnumbered.
Nah. You forget I grew up on all those Welches, too.
That's true.
All right, guys.
But anyway, guys, it's been great. As always, Jerry, Jay, Bobby, Bo, thanks for joining us, and happy birthday once again.
Thank you.
And we'll get together next week, and we'll do it again.
All right.
Sounds good. Good night, guys.
Take care, guys. All right.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.